Hey guys, welcome back to the Mind Yourself podcast with myself and Christy. We're here to discuss and investigate the whole topic of teenage transition or transition in school for kids from primary to secondary. Looking at kind of some of the research you've done yourself, Christy, in the field. Some of the stuff obviously we've learned from working with students through the MODIS program. So to kind of kick off and dive straight into it, first question I kind of wanted to ask you was, you know, what drove you or inspired you to go into the whole area of childhood mental health, and particularly that whole topic of transitioning from primary to secondary school?
Okay. Childhood mental health, that's a very big question, but we'll start with secondary school transition. So basically I think people don't respect secondary school transition enough. Like when you look back at your own transition or my own transition, you obviously go from being like the oldest in this primary school to the youngest in the secondary school. And it has a big impact on mental health, and I don't think this is well known. So basically, like if you have to deal with a stressor, like let's say COVID, okay, people are more, you've heard this before, people are more resilient than you think. So for example, with COVID, people were more resilient at dealing with it than we thought they would be. But the problem is, it's the people who had to deal with COVID and then a job loss and then lack of financial stability. It's like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 stressors all together. That's when it becomes an issue. So it's called like contemporaneous stressors, essentially. So all of these things happening at the same time. Now, when you take secondary school transition into account, think back now to when you were 13, 14. So you had puberty. So your body was changing and your hormones were changing in your body. And basically all you got shown probably was that you were going to grow some, you were told you were going to grow some hair and then shown pictures of like penises and vaginas. That was kind of all we were told about puberty. Then on top of that, then you have an increased sensitivity to stress. So you start getting more moody. That's a hormonal change that comes with puberty. You then have more independence. So you're away from your parents more. So you get probably given a small budget. Then on top of that, you have to transition academically. So the work gets a lot harder. You get punished for the work that you haven't done. Then on top of that, then you have to deal with the social status things. You start caring more about what other people think of you. Then you have social media. And the point I'm making is, there's so many changes that happen in one go, and people just assume that, oh, they're just going from sixth class to first year, it's not a big deal. But in fact, it actually has a big role to play in mental health. And so it's been found, research has shown that for some students, it can lead to drops in academic performance, it can lead to instability of depressive symptoms, and it can lead to lots and lots of psychopathology, so future mental health issues. And so I don't think it's addressed well at all in schools. I think schools at the moment, they focus on the academic side, but they don't look at the social emotional side. And that's what I was trying to do, basically trying to fill that gap.
Yeah. And like, just kind of, because obviously, like, it's been, you know, from a biological standpoint, it's pretty obvious that probably that phase in people's lives from like 12 to 18 is like one of the biggest when it comes to biological changes in humans, in people. So obviously we've known that for a long time. Even when you're in school, it's still addressed, whether it's addressed well. We can talk about that for another day in regards to sex education and those things. But so like, how long, you know, how, you know, how much later did it take the psychology kind of field to pick up around the kind of psychological changes and challenges that go through that phase? Because that, it's probably been well known about the biological changes, but as you said, it's only more recently been researched from the kind of mental health and psychological standpoint.
Yeah, so this is something particularly one of my supervisors, Samantha Dockery, she would look at. Basically, a lot of her research is around that, like, we focus too much on age and not enough on puberty. In that, like, puberty is a huge predictor of mental health symptoms. Like, for example, with girls, girls that hit puberty earlier, they're treated differently because obviously their bodies develop quicker. And so as a result, they're treated differently by society. And one of the really important findings of the research that I've done is that across the transition, girls' psychological well-being seems to drop while boys seem to manage it okay. And I think because girls hit puberty earlier, I think it's off the top of my head about 8 months on average earlier than boys. as a result, I think that has a role to play. Girls have a lot more to deal with from a younger age. And so, that is the kind of the big, I think, point to take, is that girls, particularly across that transition, the psychological feel, like you were saying, they're starting to become aware of that. Because as they then go through adolescence, then girls have worse mental health than boys, generally speaking. This is in the adolescent years. Now it kind of changes then as they get older. And so girls need to be targeted for these kind of interventions like the Motive Programme and stuff like that. But going back to your question, sorry, I'm rambling. Going back to your question, I suppose, like, there has been an awareness for a long time. Like, it's been puberty more so than secondary school transition that's the focus. But the reason why I find secondary school transition interesting is it's just everything happens at once, and then you're just put into, like, if you look back, I don't know about your experience, but my secondary school was like a jungle. It literally was, like, there was so much happening, there was so much to adapt to, like, particularly, like, forget about even all of the things I listed earlier, just the difference of being around the same people for 8 years and then being put in a new environment where there's so many new people. I remember it was very, very difficult to adapt to at the time. But again, it was just something that I think we just had to adapt to. Do you know, like, we were just like thrown there and then we needed to adapt. But like, what we're trying to figure out is some children, they won't adapt. They'll struggle. And so we need to be able to target those children, to identify them, and then to kind of help them better adapt to it. Yeah. Like, that's the important thing.
And I suppose, like you said as well, and it's maybe a very Irish reference, but, you know, for people who were educated in a rural, you know, smaller rural areas, going from that very small primary school to like the big regional or, secondary school, that's also a big change, going from being like, you know, one of, as well as feeling like, you know, going from, as you said, kind of center of attention or a much, you know, closer attention with teachers and with colleagues, to now just being one of a number of 1,000 students. Yeah. That's also a big impact.
It actually wasn't the primary focus of our study, but I remember looking at it because we looked at the data between rural schools and urban schools. And we also looked at, if there was a crossover from rural to urban or rural to staying in, you know, like rural secondary school. And results found that the mental health or the psychological well-being of children in the rural schools was actually better. And again, like, I know as a researcher, I shouldn't say this. You'll notice me say this a lot. But my understanding of that, my prediction of that would be that I feel that rural schools have a greater sense of community. And when that, like, kind of community, that social support is stable across the transition, I think that's a really beneficial thing to psychological well-being. So, I think when you're going from rural to urban, I think if you still have a group of friends with you that are going doing the same thing, I think that helps massively. But if you're going rural to urban and you're by yourself, I think that's a recipe for disaster. I think it's too much change. And then on the topic of rural as well, because in Ireland in general, the other finding that was interesting with our research was sports participation. That was a major predictor across the transition as well. And that makes sense, because basically if you're involved in a team, regardless of secondary school, you're still going to be part of that team, like a club team, like a GAA team.
Yeah.
And so that consistency, I think, is really, really important. It's very, very important that there's consistency across the transition, some bit of consistency. So that, because as I mentioned already, the more changes, the more difficulties. So you kind of want to slow it down, essentially.
Okay. Okay. And obviously you mentioned from a long way back, both, you know, the lack of, you know, research, maybe particularly in that transition field, the fact that it was kind of a field that's growing with new insights, it kind of drew you towards it. You know, how early on, you know, did you kind of think this is something you really wanted to kind of dig your teeth into? Because obviously it's been the bedrock of a lot of what you do now, what we do at Modus. You know, how far back did you have a clear picture that you wanted to kind of figure out how this transition works?
So I should start by saying, the previous research on secondary school transition, it's not that it's very new. there's a lack of it definitely in Ireland. So like Jennifer Simmons would be a big name, but she would have worked a lot more in the UK, and then they would look at secondary school transition in the US and Australia as well. But the problem is in the US, there's a transition from primary school to middle school and then middle school to secondary school. So that's kind of a different dynamic that I don't always think is comparable to Ireland. And then the other thing is between Ireland and the UK, the UK transition a year earlier than Ireland. So, and I think that dynamic is also very interesting. So in Ireland, the typical age that you transition would be 13, but in the UK, it's 12. Again, this is not backed up by research. My personal opinion is that later is better because it increases the chances that they've hit puberty before they've transitioned. I think when they're younger, they're going to go into secondary school and then they're going to hit puberty. And I think it's too much. But yeah, so there is research there anyway, about secondary school transition, but in relation to secondary school transition in Ireland, as far as I'm aware, we're the first paper to look at that in Ireland. And I think Ireland's quite unique in relation to, as I mentioned already, you have the rural and the urban, but also you have the sports participation in relation to the GAA, and there's like more of a community setting too. But then, yeah, it's just about like, it's not only about identifying, I suppose, across the transition, but it's also like, what can we do for children to help them as well? That's something that's not been touched on at all. And answering your question, why did I look into it? I just think it's important. I think it's the most important stage. I think so many things change that's where they need the support, particularly like the general population need it. And it's also an opportunity because early adolescents, they become more independent across the transition. And so that's when they need the education so that can guide them. They can't depend on their parents anymore when they're getting the bus into school or when they're, being bullied at lunchtime. You know, they have to be able to deal with it themselves. And so I think the education can be really, really pinnacle then.
Basically. Yeah, yeah. And you mentioned how, that kind of everything landing, you know, all of these kind of, you know, mental challenges landing at one point, this is what makes puberty such a key phase in development. You know, has there been much research into, or what's the kind of research behind, if that's not cared for or managed correctly, the impacts of quite a challenging, you know, puberty experience or teenage experience for a child on later development as they go into adulthood?
Yeah, so the mental illness onset, like statistics, is that before the age of 13, it has the highest onset of mental health issues, basically. So in relation to, you hear lots of people talking about early intervention now. That has to be the target point then. If we want to prevent future mental health problems, we need to target the age range of that transition. Again, it's about kind of limiting the stability. I've mentioned that before, that's the important thing, making sure that there is as much stability as possible. So limiting like lots of changes. And if you think about it, like, I think when you focus on like fourth and fifth class, your maths is getting a bit more difficult and you're growing up a bit, but it's not a massive change. But you compare that then to sixth to first year and not for everybody, but for a lot of students, everything changes. And so that's kind of like, it's adapting to that change. It's stressful. You know, that is like the definition of stress, is being put in a new environment and having to adapt. And so that's stressful. And so it makes sense. If you don't adapt successfully there, your stress system is going to be dysregulated. If your stress system is dysregulated, that can have an impact on unhelpful thinking, unhelpful emotions, unhelpful behaviors. And then as a result, then that can lead to mental health issues. Kind of just makes sense that way.
Cool. And so tell me, obviously you kind of briefly touched on, those challenging aspects of, transition, of that kind of puberty phase of going from, the kind of 11, 12 years up to kind of 13, 14. Can you just kind of dig into some of those really kind of core, or give a little bit of, more color to those most important kind of developmental challenges that kids will face for people to be aware of?
Yes, and I'm very happy when I can actually just break this down into three things that are very, very easy to comprehend. First thing, most importantly, undoubtedly, is social support. So basically social support across the transition really matters. So we already touched on this in that it's very, very important that friends stay together across the transition. And I don't know if what was your experience with this, but I remember we were never consulted on across the transition. If you were going to be in your friend, if your friend was going to be in your class. I remember from my primary school, I wasn't in the same class as any of my of the students from my primary school. And it's a big, big thing, particularly like obviously Finland have nailed secondary school transition. Like they're brilliant at everything. One thing they do is they make sure that the secondary school is informed of what students are coming in, and then they set the classes according to who their friends are. You write down in your application who are your friends that are going to the secondary school, and they keep them together. Now, do you know, the idea behind this is some people would say, oh, if you're going into a new setting, you group friends together, they won't meet any other people.
That's what people always say. They won't make other friends.
Yeah. But who cares? You know, like it's not about having lots of friends. It's about having a friend. That's the important thing. So that stability is really, really important. And then for like any parents listening now, like I really, really don't recommend you putting your child in a class or in a new school where they're not with any of their friends. Now, there are exceptions. Like let's say a child was maybe bullied in primary school. They don't have any friends in primary school. Then it's a new start. That can be a good thing. But for children who do have friends, try and keep them together. That is more important than anything else across that transition. Because they're trying to adapt to enough things other than having to make lots of new friends as well. You know, it's always good to have a kind of anchor. So that's the peer support. Then on the topic of support, then huge thing that goes down across the transition is think about it now. You have very good relationships with all of your teachers, particularly your sixth class teacher before you transition. Then you go into secondary school and you have lots of different teachers. And that teacher support goes down hugely. Like it's not uncommon for secondary school teachers to not know who their students are starting off. And this is not blaming the secondary school teachers because they obviously are working with lots of different students. So it's understandable. But the issue is there needs to be more systems in place that basically makes sure that there's kind of like a specific teacher to each class. And I know there's like class tutors and stuff, but like not even teacher to class, but teacher to maybe like 5 or 10 students. That's what should be happening, because again, they go from having lots of support from their teacher to having no support from any teachers. So it's very, very important that they still have a kind of outlet or a teacher that they can go to basically if they have an issue. That's really important. So other than social support then, you have peer support, you have teacher support, and then you have parent support. Parents, difficult time for them because your child starts having independence. But what's very, very important is don't make decisions for them. This is what they're meant to do. They're meant to grow up. So guide them, but don't be overly involved. That's the idea then. And then other than social support, then you have self-esteem. This is really, really important. So basically what it finds is if children have high self-esteem before they transition into secondary school, then more than likely they're going to adapt well if they think highly of themselves. So how do you improve that? You talk about, you help them identify what they're good at, what they're not good at, and like just like generally how they think of themselves. Academically, this is what I think is the teacher's job, to make sure that children's academic self-esteem is high. I'm not going to give advice on that because it's not my area, but I don't personally think it should be the teacher's job to make sure that their self-esteem psychologically is high. I think that's expecting too much from the primary school teachers. But that's another topic. And then the last thing I already mentioned is gender. Being a girl really, really matters. So again, like girls depend more on social support. So they'll tend to have higher social support than boys, but that's because they care more about it. So what you want to do is you basically want to reassure them that if their social circles do change, which they do in secondary school, how to adapt to that essentially.
Okay.
And then also just target emotion regulation seems to be more effective for girls rather than boys. So target emotion regulation as well. Whereas boys, stereotyping here seems to be more simple, just give them sport or give them games. That's kind of
simple needs.
Yeah, like not being stereotypical, but yeah, that is what the research shows. But okay. Boys are often more cocky going into secondary school too. They have high self-esteem more likely than girls. So, yeah, just play into that essentially.
Yeah.
Boys have more behavioral issues, going into secondary school, compared to girls. But our research hasn't really looked into that. But again, it's kind of you just change your teaching methods, I think, to adapt to that. Mm. That's kind of what I've read on it. So, yeah, sorry, I know. So three things, yeah. Social support, self-esteem, and focus on girls. That's kind of, yeah.
Okay. And tell me, so obviously you referenced Finland, and I know in nearly all the way through since we started doing the podcast, anytime we talk about any kind of interesting research, Scandinavia pops up in a lot of cases, or the Scandinavian countries. Is that one of the biggest challenges as well with this kind of topic? Because while it is obviously, you know, psychology, mental health can be compared, or, you know, person to person, because it's a biological process at times with stress and everything. Is that what is, you know, slows down development in the services that are available because of, you know, cultural difference? Or you even reference yourself the fact that, you know, schools set up in Ireland, you would assume, is similar to our nearest neighbor in the UK, but actually in reality can be quite different. So because it's not just the kind of puberty factors, gender factors that are quite repeatable, it's also the setting and the environment that people are in can be quite different. You know, what's now, is that the next phase, trying to kind of localize some of this stuff, because it can differ quite a lot?
Yeah, so one thing I would say on that is I'm not trying to be pessimistic here. Ireland are good. They're good at what they do. I don't think they've done it on purpose, but they're good. Like, for example, as I mentioned, like, most children are playing sport, you know, they might be involved in GAA. I think that's great across the transition. Most children go to the same secondary school, like the nearby secondary school, as their primary school. Like, feeder schools are a big thing in Ireland, and feeder schools are a good thing, because again, it limits that the amount of change. One thing they're not good at, like you were mentioning, yes, there are cultural differences, but one thing I don't think they're good at is there could be better, like, structures in place for the transition. So, like, for example, there could be better communication between primary and secondary schools. Like, in an ideal world, and again, this is not school blaming or teacher blaming, because I know it's, you know, they don't have the resources to do this, but in an ideal world, probably in Scandinavia, I don't know, but the primary school would have basically like a transition liaison, and the secondary school would have a transition liaison. They would constantly communicate to basically identify, okay, academically, this child's like this, this child's like this. Socially and emotionally, this child's like this, this child's like this. And then they'd kind of make a plan. Okay, so this child is struggling. Let's say this child hasn't made any friends, for example. So
yeah,
what the secondary school should do is the child should put that child in a class with other children who haven't made many friends or haven't really adapted. And then specifically in, like, let's say SPHE, teach that class about social skills. You know, you know, like, there's things like that to help them transition that I think schools could do better. But it's just kind of, they're so focused on making sure that they're academically ready that they're not looking at the bigger picture of, like, okay, maybe the child is now ready for maths, but that doesn't mean that they're able to be put in with a class with that they don't know anybody, you know, like, yeah. Social emotional is kind of pushed to the side. And I think open days, things like that, like Ireland do that. I think that's a great thing. But I think another thing I saw that was interesting was teacher swapping. This idea of kind of getting a secondary school teacher to come into the primary school class for the day, just so that they can get used to not seeing the same face every day. You know, like, there's ideas like that that I think could work quite well. And then just particularly children who don't adapt well to change, have a few days in primary school where they go into the secondary school and, like, they're shown, like, their timetable, the practical stuff, timetable, lockers, that type of thing. You know, because it's great explaining it to them in a primary school class, but it's actually better if they're in the secondary school, because they're not just, like, taking in that information, they're actually, like, seeing it, you know.
Yeah, so, experiencing it.
Yeah, so, like, going back to your question, like, yes, there are cultural differences, so it's hard to compare. That's why we're doing the research in Ireland. But on top of that, there are, like, a lot of things, like, structurally that, like, Ireland are doing great on, but there are also things that they could do better on, essentially.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. And obviously you met, yeah, because you've referenced it, obviously having done the research and the paper on this whole topic of the transition from primary to secondary or through puberty. In your research, what, I suppose, have you found kind of is probably the biggest or most complicated thing we have to overcome? And secondly, as you've been doing research, what would you say are you most excited about in how things are progressing, or maybe certain developments that are now being made in kind of the research behind this that you think, you know, coming down the line, it might be, you know, it will be interesting to see how it's implemented.
Yeah. So I'll answer your first part of that question first. Yeah. You were saying, like, what are the... I had it in my head when you asked the question, like, in relation to, like what are the main findings in relation to what do we need to be concerned about across the transition?
Yes.
Yeah. So... first thing I'll start with is three main concerns from children. So children have been asked this. There was a very recent study actually from Austria that just basically asked children, like, what are you worried about? And the three big things are, number one is it's always bullying. And if you'll probably remember this yourself as well, you hear all of these myths that your head's going to be put down a toilet, that you're going to get bags thrown at you. And some of them are true, I know. But the problem is, like, whatever you create in your head is always going to be way worse than it actually is. One thing I would say, I know obviously people can't avoid this, but having a sibling, having an older sibling is actually hugely helpful. But another thing schools can do kind of to prevent this is, first thing is what the primary school can do is they can reassure children. They can basically, like dispel all these myths that, like, they're not true. That's the first thing. As opposed to just not addressing it. And then what the secondary school can do, which I think is really good, if it works, if it's implemented well, is a kind of mentoring or like a peer system, where basically a first year gets paired with like a fourth year or a fifth year, kind of to help them, guide them through. I think that's really, really important. But then they also have a teacher as well. All you're doing is you're just creating a bigger and bigger support network for every child. The second thing that they're really worried about then is academics, is not being able to do the work or getting in trouble for not doing the work. So that again is the primary school teacher's job, but also communication between the primary school and the secondary school. And then the third and final thing is making friends. And as I mentioned, the way you overcome that is firstly give them the reassurance that they'll be with their old friends, but then also then, you know, social skills, like stuff we cover in the MOTLS program, that should be being taught in sixth class and in first year. That's really important. And now I don't remember your second question.
Was more about the developments, in the research, or like the maybe certain things that are early phased kind of insights from some of the research you've been seeing that you think will be quite impactful or exciting in the future.
So it just goes down to basically like what our research paper found is we were just looking at basically what happened across the transition and then what predicts psychological well-being across the transition. That was basically the two main aims of one of our papers. And basically like what it showed is that it's actually consistent enough, it's similar enough to like research from the UK and America in that, again, social support, self-esteem in girls, they're the predictors, and then also for psychological well-being. And then like in relation to changes across the transition, the most variable is self-esteem and social support. So it's kind of just making sure that they're okay. So I suppose the next obvious step is if we know they're kind of like in danger, then we should be teaching it. So how do you teach to improve self-esteem? Well, you improve self-awareness. You basically make children more aware of like their emotions, their thoughts, their behaviors, who they are, what their strengths are. And once they know more about themselves, then that improves their self-esteem. And then in relation to social support, how do you improve social support? Well, you improve social skills. You make them more sociable. You make them you teach them how to interact better with people, how to become more likable, improve their emotional intelligence, essentially. And then that's how you do it. And again, the cheap plug, obviously, is that's what MOTLS are doing. That's the kind of idea. And we've talked about in the past podcast, basically what the findings are on the evaluation of MOTLS. That's kind of it. The other thing I forgot to mention as well is evaluation in primary school and secondary school. That's really, really important. What schools should be doing, it's in the new wellbeing framework now, is schools should be evaluating the wellbeing of their students. And they should be looking at, does it get better or does it get worse? If it gets worse, you need to put plans in place. You're not doing a good job. If it's getting better, how do you make it even better? that's kind of, that's what we should be pushing towards. But if you don't measure it, you don't know. So, like, you know, you just do a small well-being checklist, basically, like once every 2 months. It's very simple.
Yeah.
It takes 5 minutes.
That's what I was about to ask. I was like, you know, how are there kind of template or frameworks that, you know, people can use for this assessment to just take a marking of someone's well-being?
So Ireland had a well-being framework from 2018 to 2023. Basically prioritizing well-being in the school, that it has to be part of the ethos now. And one of the things that is included, all teachers will know this anyway, and if parents don't know this, they'll be reassured. They have to have evidence-based programs in their schools now, and they also have to have well-being, like, of the children is like the main goal of a school, is essentially what it should be. They have a well-being checklist that students should fill out, and then they explain, like, if you're not meeting your targets, then this is what you should do. But it will be interesting now, because this is going to be, we're coming in now to the first year, and we'll know now how prepared schools are. They're probably not realistically, but
probably not. But
again, you're just pushing.
And one of those things I know people sometimes say, you know, with self assessment and checklist, you know, how accurate are they? I'm sure you've looked into it. You know, how effective are these assessments in helping just get a marker so schools can address? We've talked about early intervention. It's not going to diagnose anyone, but at least, you know, can highlight potential risk students to kind of pay more attention to. Like, how effective are these assessments?
Like, they're obviously validated assessments. Like, they're not huge. They're just paper and pencil, like, you know, fill it out. But one thing I would say is, you're doing two things too. Firstly, you're normalizing in the school that the school care about well-being, that they're at least evaluating it. Second thing is, again, teachers are too busy. They mightn't always pick up on it, but sometimes you will catch the child who is struggling, but they won't tell anybody about it. They'll fill out the assessment, and that'll kind of identify it then. But then the next step, and this is the difficult part, you've kind of touched on this already, is, like, once you identify the vulnerable students, yes, you can put in resources in place, but then it's up to the mental health system to kind of step up. And we obviously know in Ireland it's not there. Like, the child will probably be put on a waiting list. But the idea is, in relation to prevention, is, like, yes, it will help identify the student, but at the same time, like, we unfortunately won't be able to help every single student, but we'll be able to identify them firstly, and then for all of the others, we make sure that they don't fall under, you know, like, if mental health is a continuum, like, they remain having stable or high well-being. That's a very good preventative way of dealing with mental illness. If you have high well-being, you're unlikely to have mental illness. That's the kind of idea. And so you need to put these structures in place to help them deal with that.
Yeah. And I know this is a slightly off topic, but it'd be just interesting to just get your view on it. This concept of, you know, researching transition, and transition as, you know, this is just transition for schooling and puberty, but kind of the triggers or, you know, challenges that any kind of transition anyone faces in their life, there are probably fundamental components that are repeated or are similar depending on what stage in your life and what you're transitioning from and to. Is there evidence that some of the research and work that can be done to help make that transition from, you know, primary to secondary school and that puberty phase easier? Can some of those be repeated for people transitioning at other areas in their life, be it from secondary school to university, university to a job, out of one job into another job? Because you started the conversation about people losing their jobs during COVID, maybe, you know, going through challenging times, being stuck at home, so missing out on that family connection. Are there certain things that people, because obviously everyone listening to this isn't maybe always a parent, is there certain things that there is relevance in this research to just generally any transition you may face in life?
Yeah, so I suppose the measure of transition would be stress tolerance. It's your ability to deal with a new environment. The three things that cause stress is a lack of controllability, a lack of being able to, like, predict what's going to happen, and the third one's after going for me now, but that is going into secondary school. If you think about it, you don't have control over the situation, and you also can't predict what's going to happen. So, like, the idea behind it is what research shows is that if you can improve emotional intelligence, it improves stress tolerance, your ability to deal with stress, essentially. And so you're better able to deal with transitions. And I think about it. It's really, really important, this idea of kind of like, you know, jumping, like taking the leap to go do something. Like those type of things, like the bigger picture is if you're willing to take the leap, I think more times than not, you're going to learn a lot more. And so over time, yes, you'll make mistakes, but you'll make those mistakes will then determine your decision making down the line. That's the idea. That's how you develop as a person. If somebody has very high stress tolerance, they're going to be avoidant. They're not going to want to transition. They're not going to want to put themselves into new situations. And as a result, they obviously become more narrow-minded then as a result, because they haven't experienced life, essentially. So this is really, really important, not just in relation to like mental illness, like distress tolerance, but I think it's also important in relation to like character development, I suppose you'll phrase it. Sorry, I'm starting to sound like a life coach now or something, but you know, you need to be able to put yourself in new environments. And that's also it's actually not something that I've highlighted enough on, so thank you for highlighting it for me. But I think like the first big transition is the transition from play school or just the home into primary school. You don't have much control over that. You have no independence, essentially. It's just moving from the caregiver of parent to the caregiver of your junior or infant teacher. Transition in secondary school is way different, because you go from transitioning into being cared for by your primary school teacher, by your primary school principal, and by your parent, to then peers matter and I have a bit of independence. So I think that governs the rest of your life.
That
sounds extreme. And like, and it's not just us, like there's animals, like I know this is going to be a poorly paraphrased story, but I know Bob Sapolsky, he's in stress research. He's worked a lot with animals, and it's the norm of like tribes of, I don't know what type of monkey, that basically when they become adolescent, they're kicked out essentially, and they have to go fend for themselves. They're completely left alone. Yeah. And so they have to like try and integrate into a new group essentially. And like, I think there's parallels there, like not as extreme, but you're essentially put into a new world and you have to adapt. But the advantage that we have is we can teach these individuals how to adapt better.
Yeah.
That's the
idea. It's not just throw it in and sink or swim.
Yes. Because that's what I think a lot of people have done in the past. And I think it's not a good concoction in relation to mental health. I think it's dangerous. Yeah.
So kind of, you know, coming close to the end, but you've referenced, obviously, we've done a lot of research. You've done a lot of research as part of your PhD. It is what informs a lot of what we do at MOTUS. You know, you've talked about how there is a role to play for schools. There's considerations parents have to take just knowing their kids are going through this phase in life. You've referenced the kind of doing assessments so schools can get a general marker as to where all their schools, their students are. Where do services like what we do at MOTUS fit in this kind of web of support networks with, you know, what responsibility are we taking on, you know, because as we mentioned, it's not realistic for parents and teachers to be able to understand everything and take it all on board.
Yeah. Okay. So there's a few things here. The first thing I'd say is, if we're getting into the schools, the social emotional learning program, that is the baseline, essentially, that if we can kind of educate the children on how to take care of their mental health, like we often see it, you mightn't see the effects straight away. But the thing is, when the child does come into a different difficult situation, it'll be in the back of their head. That's the idea. And they can test it out. And if it ends up working, then they're more likely to use it. It's not about they have to use it, you know, because some tools that we teach won't work for them. And that's okay. It's about like, you know, adapting it to the individual. The second thing then is, as you mentioned, it's the early assessment. It's kind of, children aren't aware that they have issues because they don't have the language around it. So when we go in and we kind of talk about the language about the mind and about mental health, we kind of give them the language to articulate, oh, well, I actually felt this way when this happened, so maybe I should talk about that. Or maybe I should use this emotion regulation strategy. And if I can't deal with it, another big thing we address is kind of where to go then. that's a big, big issue. Like, we always promote jigsaw in our workshops, and most children don't know what jigsaw is. So it's also highlighting the supports if they feel they can't deal with it themselves. And then it's just improving the job as well for the teacher and for the parent. There's no handbook on parenting. A lot of parents don't know what they're doing. That's understandable, because why would they? You know, like, there's no education for parents. So that's what we're trying to provide. And then for the teachers, is taking the pressure off them. Teachers should, in my opinion, should only be expected to get children academically ready, you know, for life, not only for secondary school, but for life. They shouldn't have to deal completely with the social emotional aspect as well. They're already juggling how many jobs, and then now they're expected to do that as well, and that's a job in itself. And then the final thing then is identifying again the children who are struggling. I think we can do better with that. That is what MOTUS are trying to do. Essentially, we're trying to improve that. It's going to take a while, but trying to remove the over reliance on the current health system, because obviously it's not doing its job. So
okay, good stuff. Before we wrap up, is there anything from your research you want to highlight that maybe we haven't touched on?
One thing I do want to highlight is how do we know if children are vulnerable? I think that's important too. You know, like, if we give them the language, and then I've been talking about some children won't adapt, even if they have, you know, the education, they won't adapt well. A big part of my research, interestingly, is looking at cortisol. So cortisol is basically the stress response in the body, the hormone. And what we were specifically looking at was the cortisol awakening response. So what this is that 30 minutes after awakening, the norm is that when you're asleep, your cortisol level will be flat. And then when you wake up in the morning, it shoots up. That's a natural response because you need to prepare for the day. And once it shoots up, then after the cortisol awakening response, it should then start to drop. That's kind of the expected way of the day. But what the research shows is that for some students, what might happen is it might shoot up and then it might stay up. And that just means that they have an elevated cortisol level throughout the day. And then that kind of explains, now I'm simplifying this, but, you know, hyperactivity. That would be an example of a child. They're too active. They have too much energy. Whereas what then also can happen, particularly for those children who have high cortisol over time, is that it doesn't go up at all. It just stays flat in the morning and throughout the day. And that kind of ties closely with, like, depressive symptoms, because basically they have no energy. That's the kind of idea there. Now, again, in an ideal world, I think it would be really cool to look at children's cortisol level as they transition into secondary school. That is what we did. I don't have the results for that yet, so I can't speak about it. But, like, I think it could be a possible future marker to tell, okay, this child is having issues in this regard because their cortisol awakening response is like this. I think that's important too. And then just in a more general basis, then, children with low self-esteem, pay particular attention to them. Children with no social support, it could be at home or it could be with their peers. And then children who went through trauma, obviously. Children who went through trauma are going to have dysregulated cortisol, but obviously they're going to have a lot more issues with that as well. It's very, very important that they have the right care then. In relation to references, I have a few here, like Hannah Wald in Australia, Van Rens in Holland, Jenny Simmons, who's actually in UCD, and then the STARS team in UCL and the University of Cardiff, Lucy Riglin and co. If you look up any of their research, they give great insight into secondary school transition.
We'll put those references in the show notes so people be able to find them, because it's a mouthful to try and remember it. Just before we close, can you just list out those 3 points, or what was it? The summary of what schools and teachers and the parents should take away from this. Because I know we referenced it, we went into detail, but just in closing, like, just your kind of bullet point as to what they should remember.
Okay. So across secondary school transition, we need to pay particular attention to a child's self-esteem, to a child's social support, and to girls specifically. Structures need to be better between primary schools and secondary schools. More communication. Parents need to be involved, but not overbearing. And a simplified sport. I know not everybody's into sport either, but if children aren't into sport, then you know, like some other social aspect, it could be gaming or whatever, or like just social clubs, art, music, dance, whatever, but just again, just so that they have that stability across the transitions, really, really important. And sorry, one extremely important thing as well, I just also want to thank my two supervisors, Dr. Jennifer McMahon and Dr. Samantha Dockery, for all of their help today. I wouldn't be where I am without them, so massive thank you to them as well.
Perfect. Yeah, as we said, there's been a lot of information there. We will have any of those kind of references we'll put in the show notes. Obviously, as you said, there will hopefully, from our own research with the cortisol levels in students, we might get even more insights to share in the future as those results come out. We're going to have a lot of other topics kind of covered this season. We'll also have maybe at least another episode or two with yourself on some of the other stuff we found with our research. And if anyone has any questions, feel free to reach out to us on all of our social media. Follow the podcast to wait so you can get up to date on the latest episodes. And until next time, mind yourselves.